2FM Mornings
with Laura Fox
Podcast.
Sponsored by Maxall. From kids' lunches to tonight's dinner, you'll find bags more to get you through the week at Maxall.
Now, Ireland's new gambling regulator has started work, but how much damage has been done in recent years as gambling moved from shops to online to mobile devices? Gambling addiction is something that my next guest, Emma Kavanagh, Head of Clinical Services at the Rutland Centre, knows all about. Emma, thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us today. I'm going to bring you right up to this mic here, if that's okay with you. Like, there's so much to get through here because it's, you know, gambling we all know about and it seems quite harmless in so many scenarios. But how would you define a gambling addiction?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lauren. Like we were just chatting off air, I was saying that that's a question that comes through so much in our phone lines, and what that looks like oftentimes is a family member ringing up and saying, this is what's going on in the home. Is this normal? Should I be worried about it? We get individuals ringing and saying, this is what I'm doing. Like, what do you think? Is this normal? Should I be worried about it? And I suppose what I would say and what Rutland would say is, we tend not to have very kind of black and white, hard and fast rules about what is a gambling addiction, what isn't. And what I mean by that is we're not too hung up in, if you bet this amount per week, you definitely have an addiction. If you spend this amount of hours, you know, per week in the bookies or on an app, you definitely have an addiction. What we're more interested in is, I suppose, how your gambling behaviour impacts your functionality across a couple of core aspects of your life. And the World Health Organization would kind of back that kind of way of approaching it as well too. So we're looking at, how does your gambling affect you physically? How does it affect you psychologically? How does it affect you emotionally? How does it impact your relationships, the people that are close to you? How does it impact your employment, your leisure pursuits? How does it impact your ability to manage your finances? All of these things. And if it's starting to impact these aspects of your life in a negative fashion, but yet you're continuing to do it, like, we know that some threshold has been crossed there. And I suppose that makes sense. If anything in your life is causing negative consequences and yet you're doing it, there's something in that.
You mentioned there about how it affects you physically. Yeah. Like, how would it affect someone physically?
Well, I think what we hear from people and what I hear from clients is, you know, insomnia might be a thing. So people are up at night, they're unable to sleep because they're stressed. Stress levels is a physiological kind of response to being in the throes of a gambling addiction. Elevated blood pressure, all of these kind of things. If you're not sound of mind, that starts to play out in the body as well too. So addiction can manifest physiologically in all sorts of different ways for people.
So someone who comes to the Rutland store or, you know, on the phone line with you guys and is looking for help, like, how does addiction usually present in people who, like, who are arriving to you?
People generally present to us, well, firstly, actually, probably the most common way people come in is through a family member. Oftentimes it's family who see the signs first, because there's a huge level of denial oftentimes for people who are in addiction. And we can see denial as kind of a malicious thing, but actually a lot of the time it's a psychological defense for the individual, because it's very painful, shameful, stigmatizing to be in addiction. So oftentimes we hear from family first, and they might sometimes cajole their loved one then into making contact, or they might just go back and provide the information. But for the individuals coming into us, what we see is people generally who are at crisis point. Generally, the consequences have mounted to such a point that people are very distressed and they're now realizing that they need help. And like I was saying around, you know, impact on functionality, those are all the things that we see when people come in. We see relationships in tatters. We see jobs on the line. We see people's self-esteem and self-worth and mental health really, really impacted. So people are low, they're at crisis. People are very scared as well too. I think when people come to a place where they realize there's a problem, like, that's a scary place to be. When you're in denial, it's less scary in a way. But to realize there's a problem also comes with it the thought of, what if I can't fix this now? Like, I've acknowledged it's here, but, like, what if I can't fix this? What if I can't get well?
It is truly the rock bottom. It's, you know, and I totally understand that people who are coming to the Rutland Centre as well are want to be helped and want to get better, but it is a serious addiction. And it's incredibly hard to then realize, oh my God, there could be a possibility where I don't come out the other end of this, which is what your thoughts would be playing with you. Can you explain the feeling or the buzz that gambling addicts are chasing?
Yeah, I think gambling is a very kind of high octane, high adrenaline kind of addiction. And what's really happening is dopamine is at play, and dopamine is our pleasure center. It's our feel good drug. And when we're gambling, the dopamine levels in our brain are really unnaturally high, up to 10 times more high than they might be from a more normally derived pleasurable outcome, like being with your kids might take your dopamine levels up to maybe a twofold increase. Yeah. A gambling high might take them to a tenfold increase. So it's really, really elevated. And what happens is over time, our brains become accustomed to these elevated levels. And really then the gambling creates a deficit when we're not engaging in it that yeah. only it can then match, which leads people into this phenomenal, this occurrence, I suppose, of craving, which is then what brings people oftentimes back into gambling yeah. again.
I mean, it's just such a vicious circle, isn't it? Because you are chasing that high the whole time, and it's, you know, everything that is kind of being bulldozed in the wake of it.
Yeah.
If someone comes into the Rutland Centre, like what does treatment look like for somebody who's suffering from a gambling addiction?
Yeah, we have lots of different kind of ways that we or lots of programs, lots of different options for people around treatment. So we have an inpatient residential program, and that's a 5-week program where people come and live with us, and they're with us 24/7, and they engage in a whole suite of group work, that's kind of psychotherapy group work, one-to-one group work, holistic therapies like art therapy, movement and dance therapy, and they engage in different psychoeducational lectures, which are all centered around issues to do with recovery. So it okay. might be relapse prevention, it might be self-esteem, might be relationship building. And also as part of that program, we have family day once a week, because we're big on family in Rutland. We say addiction doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
It happens within a context, within a system, and it affects everyone in that system. So once a week, family members come in, they're part of the group therapy process. So that's our residential inpatient program. We have a 10-week outpatient program as well too, and we have the new pilot gambling and gaming addiction sitting under that department. We okay. partnered with the HSC and the Department of Health recently to deliver that, and people live at home in the community, but they come up on site twice a week for group therapy, and then they also come up additionally for one-to-one work and okay. for some psychoeducational work as well too.
So the outpatient is 10 weeks and the inpatient is 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And then obviously all of the help and support that goes alongside that, because it's not just a, you know, a 5 week stint or a 10 week stint. There's a lot more work that has to be done outside of that, I assume.
There is. And I think outcomes are always better for people who engage in aftercare, because yeah. being in a primary treatment program like the inpatient or the outpatient program is very, very intense, but it's also very supportive. You're yeah. essentially wrapped in cotton wool in a cocoon, I suppose, and then you have to go back to normal living, to community living, and that's oftentimes where the challenges exist for people, because they have done an immense amount of really deep work on themselves yeah. to make the behavioural changes that are necessary, but they go back into an environment which oftentimes is the exact same. The stressors are the same, the triggers are the same, all of those, the access is yeah. the same. So aftercare is really important, and we do have a 1 to 2 year aftercare program, and everyone who comes through one of our primary programs go on to that. Anyone who's come through our pilot program, which is a free program for people, also get a free place on our aftercare.
Okay.
And the aftercare program is a really large program. We have up to 250 people in it at any one time, and it's staffed by our MDT, and we have a couple of different services within that. So we have, for example, a stabilization service, so if people experience relapse, because people do sometimes relapse yeah. in addiction, and it's not often spoken about, but it is a part of it sometimes, and it's really important that we're able to put in place additional supports when we need to, so we have that service there. We also have a transition program as part of our aftercare program, and that's I suppose came in response to us identifying that relapses are most likely to happen for people in that early period when they're leaving a high intensity yeah. support service and going back into the community. We would say anywhere between immediately leaving and up to 3 months is people's most vulnerable period for relapse. So we have a specific program, a transition program in place to try and support people more in that time in their lives in particular. And again, like with all our stuff in Rutland, there's a strong focus on family. So family members come and join our aftercare yeah. program in their own right as well too, so that they can go on their recovery journey, because they've often been left very, very impacted, traumatised possibly yeah. even by the experience by proxy of going through the addiction.
That's what I was going to say. The family day that, you know, where you bring up some of the family members like once a week and stuff, and how incredibly important it is to have a support network around you. But the family can be affected as much, if not more, because they've watched all this happening and they can't, you know, do anything about it. So you guys yeah. offer a support network for them as well.
We do. And I think, yeah, families can be seriously impacted. And in some ways, they have gone through it in their senses.
Yeah.
In a way, they haven't had the outlet of the gambling, of the using, of the drinking. So they're severely impacted. So we do have a family program, like every Tuesday in Rutland is Family Day. Families will come up and be part of the therapy group, but they also have their own separate groups on that day, which okay. are support groups. They'll meet other families who have also been impacted. They will share experiences. They will get a lot of validation and reassurance. And they will also go to a psychoeducational lecture that day, and that will all resource them with skills skills around how to manage addiction.
Because I imagine as well, if you are a family member who's going through this, whether you're a son or a daughter, a mother or father, you know, like a husband, wife, whatever it might be, it might be incredibly hard to say how you're really feeling with the other person in the room with you, because you don't want them to relapse and you don't want them to feel guilty. But essentially, you're probably fuming a little bit at this scenario.
Yeah, absolutely true. Yeah. And it can be a fine line for families to walk between needing to have a voice and articulate how they feel and how they felt without wanting to drive someone into relapse. So that's managed very carefully, very tentatively and very skillfully by our therapists on site, because people, when they're recovering, yes, we need to be sensitive with them, but also we need to be honest with them about the impact. Like, realizing the impact that your addiction has had on yourself and on the people around you is one of the biggest motivators for change for people. So it needs to happen, but it needs to be managed in a very safe way. And so when we're doing that kind of work, we're making sure that the families are given all the information and supported in the aftermath of it. And we're making sure that the individuals are supported in the aftermath of it as well. And the following day, on a Wednesday after family day, it's a very quiet, very reflective day in Rutland. You'll feel it in the energy. I'll just have to walk on site tomorrow morning now, and I will instantly know what day of the week it is by the feel. So we're very mindful of people that day, and we're engaged in lots of follow-ups with families as well too.
Emma, let's talk about smartphones, because it's so easy to access, you know, any form of gambling at the touch of a button without anybody actually realizing what you're doing. But what changes have smartphones brought to the world of gambling addicts?
I think look, they're a huge part of the problem. I think in generations gone by, to gamble, you had to leave your house. You had to go to the bookies, which is a separate premise. You had to get in your car. You had to make the decision to go. There was limitations through opening hours and all the rest. So there was kind of lots of opportunity for you to interrupt the behaviour at different points. Now the thought comes into your head to gamble, and without there needing to be even another second, it's in your hand at the touch of a button, you know. So definitely it's playing a role. I think we have far greater reach out than ever before, like through apps, through the smartphones. We can reach kind of worldwide platforms. We can bet on sporting events from all over the world. There will always be content to bet on, and we'll be able to access deals in other jurisdictions and other locations as well. So that's definitely part of the problem. But there's far greater reach in also, like, smartphones come with us everywhere. I know lots of people who eat with them, sleep with them, bring them into the bathroom with them when they're showering, when they're going to the toilet, when they're brushing their teeth. So they're always with us. And while they're with us, the gambling industry is essentially has access to us. And what I hear from people when they're in group therapy and in one-to-one therapy with me is talking about the effect that that has, all the kind of prompts to return to play, all the incentives to return to play. So definitely smartphone is playing a huge role in this.
Do you think because of that as well, are you getting an upsurge, I suppose, of younger people who are addicted to gambling?
Yeah, I think the typical profile of someone who comes in through Rutland is men in their 20s, 30s and 40s. Bank of Ireland launched a new service recently, and actually, and it's a really good service. It's around kind of blocking gambling activity in your account. But as part of that kind of launch, they also launched or released stats on their card users. And their card users are probably a good representative cohort of the overall population, and it showed a huge amount of gambling activity in the male 18 to 25 year old cohort, the largest out of all of them. And it also showed a 19% increase in gambling activity in that cohort in particular as well too. So that does seem to be your stereotypical gambler.
That seems like a really great idea that your bank can block it, because, and I'm not sure if it's entirely the same, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know that when you sign up to these gambling apps, it's not just a simple case of being like, right, I'm done, and deleting your account. Like, they have, you've basically ticked that they have access to you forevermore, and it's incredibly hard to get out of it. So that's a great step that your bank can go, no, you can't take anything from here. Advertising, right? Does advertising normalize, you know, gambling in everyday life?
I would say it does. I would say gambling, or advertising, sorry, is very insidious. You know, advertising in all ways works by normalizing things by conditioning us to see them as acceptable and as benign. And of course, gambling is in no way benign. And I think gambling advertising is very clever and sophisticated because it pairs gambling with already established and acceptable pursuits like sports and other leisure activities, which does condition us to see it in a favorable light. And I think if we think of vulnerable populations in particular, like children and adolescents, they're much more susceptible to that level of conditioning. So advertising definitely is playing a role. Like, we're delighted that the regulator now is on board. We saw obviously that become operational in the last number of weeks, and they will have a key role to play in regulating gambling advertisement, and we would really, really welcome that.
If somebody is listening right now and they know that somebody in their life might be suffering, what are the signs that they can look out for to know, okay, I think that there might be an addiction at play here?
I think there's a couple of things particularly I would say for gambling. So I would say an increase, if someone is increasing the amount that they're spending in their gambling, red flag. If someone is increasing the amount of time spent gambling, that's a red flag. If someone is becoming more preoccupied with their gambling, so if gambling is social and recreational for us, it should sit nicely alongside all the rest of our social pursuits very comfortably, very easily. But what we see when it's crossing the threshold from social use into problem use is it begins to take centre stage, and everything else in the person's life starts to then centre around it and revolve around it. We see people passing up other outlets, like, no, I won't go for a round of golf with the lads, I won't go for a coffee with the girls, because actually I have a bet on this and I need to see the outcome. So when we start to see that happening, that's a red flag. I would say irritability when someone's gambling activity is interrupted. So again, if something is social and recreational for us, we should fairly easily be able to tolerate a disruption to that or a change in plans. But when it's becoming problematic, we see people getting very heightened if you disrupt their plans or get in the way of their plans or put roadblocks in place. That would be a worrying sign for me. I think also we start to see when people are crossing the threshold into problem gambling and addictive gambling, the emergence of all these kind of cognitive distortions. So these are these false narratives that you hear people say and that people actually come to believe. And what we hear is people saying things like, sure, I can win it back. And I'll hear like just crazy stories, you know, of people who might have already lost 10 grand, but they will be convinced that the next grand they put down is going to win it all back. And if we're not immersed in that and we're kind of on the outside, we can see rationally, like, you're never going to win. The house is always going to win. This huge big industry is set up completely and solely to take your money. You're never going to win against it. But people who are crossing that threshold into problem addictive use begin to believe these narratives. And then lastly, I would say, and this one is a harder one to see from the outside, but if you get a sense that the person is possibly using to cope emotionally, like, so you notice that anytime they're angry, their go-to is to have a gamble. Anytime they're sad, their go-to is to have a gamble. That would be another worrying sign that there's a problem there as well.
We just have to get a text in there that says, just turned on my radio to hear your conversation regarding the Rutland Centre, and I can say that place saved my life. 25 years later, I'm still in recovery, and thank God for the Rutland every single day. And I encourage anyone listening to take the courage and make that call to save your life. That comes in from Natalie. I mean, that, you know, it just goes to show how many people that have been affected but have come out the other end. And I think that that's what you kind of have to focus on as well. If you are in that position where you feel like you're at rock bottom, that there is help out there. If people want to get in contact with the Rutland Centre, where can they go?
So they can check out our website and all our socials. There will be information about how to contact our reception
Amazing.
Team.
Emma, thank you so much for coming in with us and chatting with us today. That was Emma Kavanagh, Head of Clinical Services at the Rutland Centre. And just to be, you know, very, very clear, if you have been affected by any of the topics raised today, there is help available. You can go to rt.ie/helplines for more information, or you can check out the Rutland Centre on our socials. Emma, thanks a million.
2FM Mornings
with Laura Fox.
Podcast.
Sponsored by Maxall. From kids' lunches to tonight's dinner, you'll find bags more to get you through the week at Maxall.